The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, we'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Labor Lessons, What COVID Has Taught Us About Containing Viruses at Meat Plants. And the cover story begins with a second headline inside the Triangle Business Journal, Tracking COVID Across Meat Processing Plants. Officials are learning from the hard lessons of the early days of COVID-19 to better prepare for future outbreaks. Written by Lauren Onasorge. More than 50 and spreading. In April 2020, virtually all the COVID-19 cases in Duplin County appeared to be coming from a single butterball turkey plant, sparking news reports and panic in Raleigh. Tracy Simmons-Cornegay, director of the Duplin County Health Department, says her team kicked into high gear, but like many places, resources were limited as health officials were still grappling with the seriousness of the virus. This was not just an isolated North Carolina Duplin County situation, she recalls. This was a national, worldwide situation, so it's not like we could borrow resources from other places to help. Staff was limited, people were working overtime, personal protective equipment, PPE, was in short supply, and the vaccines were months away from availability. Simmons-Cornegay and other rural health directors had a big problem, and that was the food processing plants where the virus was spreading. Their workers, deemed essential as the plants contribute to the nation's food supply, were getting sick. And communications were strained, as many of those being infected in poultry plants spoke limited English. Cody Kinsley, now Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, calls 2020 a sobering and humbling experience. To get from a time when people were washing bananas to today, when 66% of the state's population has had at least one vaccine dose, is something to be proud of, he says. It was learn as you go, and learn they did, Kinsley says. Communication was both a cornerstone of the effort and one of its biggest challenges. We were all moving at such a speed, there was a time when we were doing press briefings every single day, a number of stakeholders calls every single day, he recalls. We all had more questions than answers. But are the lessons learned enough to stem future outbreaks? Officials in Duplin County hope so, but say it will take continued investment, vigilance, and communication. Newly released emails and other public records show all three were lacking in the early days of the pandemic. In 2020, the numbers were rising fast. Abigail DeVries, chief medical officer for Piedmont Health Services, wrote an email to state officials April 18, 2020, with the subject line, Poultry plants in our service area. She, like health officials virtually everywhere, was watching the numbers go up. What would we like from the state is clear communication and coordination on testing, tracking, and tracing, she wrote, adding that some, if not all, of these factories need to be closed. She added, I recognize the complication this creates with the food supply and livestock, but I fear lives will be lost without this dramatic step. PHS, which serves Alamance, Orange, Chatham, Lee, and Randolph counties, was testing through LabCorp at multiple sites, and positive numbers among employees working at poultry plants were increasing at an alarming rate. We are very worried, she wrote officials that April, warning of the potential for a real surge for local hospitals within weeks. This stretches across counties and is going to quickly spread to other industry in our area, she wrote. I'm sure there is a lot going on behind the scenes that we are not privy to. As concerned community physicians, we just want to ensure that this outbreak is a primary focus at the highest levels. Emails show conflicting policies over the months. At one plant's employee health provider, emails indicate no testing was happening, just telehealth. A partnering urgent care was just testing symptomatic employees for the flu and sending them on their way, according to a patient report. The emails coming in were keeping officials up at night. I woke up in the middle of the night worried about this and our response, Dr. Betsy Tilson, state health director, wrote her colleagues following DeVries' emails. While she liked the state's plan, which included workplace modifications, she wanted more decisive action to enhance our sample collection capability of symptomatic people. Could a team out of the National Guard be deployed to support healthcare workers at the plants? And should the state be sending in more supplies, such as hospital gowns? On April 19, Dr. Mandy Cohen, then the secretary of the NCDHHS, received an email that plants were doing temperature and symptom checks, but that employee testing was difficult. In one case, the capacity was 60 specimen collections a day, not enough to match the rising need, and local officials were worried about further spread absent social support for alternate housing and food for people who couldn't adequately quarantine. By April 27, rural hospitals were feeling the strain. An official with Wayne Memorial Hospital, which was treating some Butterball workers, told one NCDHHS worker that if 20 patients come in today, it would be challenging. Officials had been putting pressure on plants, asking them to accommodate on-site testing. Butterball, for example, had not taken up Goshen Medical's offer to bring mobile testing sites to that plant in Duplin County. Goshen did not respond to a request to comment for this story. Email shows state officials plan to reach out to Butterball executives directly to plead for on-site testing, but that testing never happened. The questions in the emails kept coming, even as officials worked to organize strike teams to assess plants. Officials distributed what they called an outbreak table, a chart that tracked COVID counts at 5 meat processing plants, but the entire contents of the chart were redacted from the records. Recipients of the chart, April 21, 2020, included Cohen and then North Carolina Director of Emergency Management Mike Sprayberry. Statistics became a necessary obsession, with officials digging into the specifics at a particular plant, the name of which was redacted. Numbers showed positive cases were higher in communities of color, but specific trends beyond that were hard to track. Dr. Shannon Dowler, Chief Medical Officer of North Carolina Medicaid, wrote officials April 29 wanting to map the numbers further, determining what job functions those testing positive had and where they were located in the plant, ideally to draw conclusions to better protect workers in other facilities. One of the complaints we heard from workers in testing was that what they showed on the news did not reflect conditions further into the plant, Dowler wrote colleagues. That sort of deep dive may be a luxury mid-pandemic, but could provide critical insights for other plants around the country if we identified a trend. Staff expanded their outbreak table to include demographic data for plants with more than 30 cases, all part of securing data that could help them fight the rising pandemic. Over the ensuing days, the table turned into a more comprehensive spreadsheet, and the calls for action kept coming. Some companies were called standouts by officials. Cohen wrote April 19 that Pilgrim's Pride and Smithfield Foods were doing all the things we would want, from paid sick leave to PPE. On April 29, the Association of Mexicans in North Carolina sent out an urgent plea for government intervention regarding a COVID-19 outbreak at a Butterball facility in Duplin County. Language barriers were complicating efforts to stem the spread. By June, Latino workers made up 39% of the confirmed COVID cases, and as many of the plants had heavy Latino employee presence, it was a continued priority for health officials, but talk started to shift from testing to the vaccine that would be coming. By November, officials were scrambling to plan for vaccine testing, working to support mobile vaccination clinics at the plants. Tilson asked colleagues on November 12 if pharmacies could help with the effort. By December, officials had communicated with 109 food processing facilities on industrial hygiene and completed 16 on-site consultations. They had a list of facilities prioritized for return visits, though the names were redacted from the records. All's quiet. Fast forward to 2022, and the virus is still here, albeit at a pace Duplin County's Simmons Cornegay says is workable, at least for now. We've got better infrastructure and resources, she says. And relationships between her department and poultry plants have strengthened, but she knows another big outbreak could be just around the corner. In January and February of this year, the county got smacked to the tune of 5,000 cases. Her team got through it, but again, both their resolve and their resources were tested. Over the months, a sense of normal has started to return. Her team is again allowed to take vacations, and patients getting COVID aren't dying, thanks in large part to the availability of vaccines. But the situation isn't over. Her wish list, more funding to prepare a response. Juvencio Roca Peralta, executive director of the Association of Mexicans in North Carolina, had heard from scared workers in 2020, alleging close working conditions in violation of the social distancing push. Today, the chatter has quieted, he says, and communication, something lacking in the early days of the pandemic, has increased threefold, making the worlds of both Simmons Cornegay and Roca Peralta more confident than in 2020. A North Carolina Latino COVID task force meets weekly to ensure the community doesn't fall through the cracks. But they nor state officials can ever forget 2020. And both admit that the situation is far from over. And that's why it's important to keep communicating and engaging, Roca Peralta says, with both state agencies and poultry firms themselves. Today, the state has testing and treatment supplies that exceed anything we could have imagined early on, NCDHHS leader Kinsley says. We have, frankly, an unrestricted supply of vaccines essentially on hand, and we have the knowledge that they are so incredibly effective in reducing the spread, he says, calling the fast vaccine timeline nothing short of a miracle. While every virus is different, Kinsley says the effort likely paid off by way of a streamlined response for a future pandemic. His department was the centerpiece in coordinating the response, and it's prepared to do it again, but clearly there's still work to do on the current pandemic. While the majority of state residents have at least one jab, 44% had opted out as of July 6. While 99% of seniors had at least one shot, surveys have indicated far less interest in vaccinating those under 5, a segment of the population only allowed its first doses in the past few weeks. And just 57% of the vaccinated population has received a booster shot. Kinsley says the goal is to get those numbers up to encourage parents to vaccinate their kids, all while preparing for the next one. He says federal dollars, while always appreciated, isn't the biggest barrier in preparing the population for another hit. I would say what worries me most is that we still have over 1 million people in North Carolina without health insurance, Kinsley says, adding that the pandemic taught everyone about the implications of pre-existing conditions and the need to stay on top of their health. Those without health insurance are less likely to call a doctor to get tested, much less get treatment for COVID-19. We really have to go to the root cause here, he says. We have to get people healthier. The companies, too, say they've learned from 2020. Butterball, which never had on-site testing, evolved its approach, eventually accommodating on-site vaccinations. Throughout the pandemic, Butterball's approach to COVID-19 testing and vaccination has evolved to accommodate accessibility and guidance from state and local health officials, a Butterball spokeswoman says. We have made significant investments in protecting our people and continue to implement additional measures as new information, best practices, and resources become available. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by Managing Editor Dane Huffman. From the Peace Corps to peanut butter. A local couple's passion for peanut butter has them in an expansion mode. Mark Overbay started making peanut butter when he was in the Peace Corps in 1999 in Zimbabwe after watching the locals roast peanuts and pound them into paste. He added honey and sea salt and says, "To be honest, it was one of the best things I'd ever tasted, partly because I hadn't had peanut butter in over a year." But Overbay adds, "It really did give me an epiphany." In 2010, he started Big Spoon Roasters, selling to farmers markets in Carrboro and Durham. Now he and his wife Megan sell to 800 retailers in the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and have 13 full-time employees and 5 part-timers. But they've outgrown their facility in Durham after expanding from 1,500 to 6,000 square feet, so the company is moving in August to a 20,000 square foot location they will lease to own in Hillsboro. The plan is to complete the purchase in November, but Overbay says the cost of upfitting has nearly doubled from when they started and now stands at $650,000. An Indiegogo fundraiser is helping out, raising $17,000 so far toward a goal of $50,000. The move will allow the company to expand product lines. For example, the site will allow more storage space and thus better pricing when buying supplies at a larger scale. It's going to allow us to produce a lot more, Overbay says. But going from Peace Corps volunteer to rising entrepreneur hasn't been easy. There was no blueprint for what we're doing, he says. We are figuring this out as we go along. Tony Durham Bar owner Healy launches online option. Durham Bar Alley 26, a recent James Beard Award finalist, has launched an online store. The bar is known for making its tonic and cocktail syrups in-house and will now be selling them through its website. Shannon Healy, owner of Alex 26, began crafting his tonic syrup recipe while working as the general manager of Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill, a restaurant he now owns. "I wanted a tonic that let the craft of gin distillers still shine through," Healy says. Healy has sold his syrup to bars, restaurants, and retail shops since 2015. During the pandemic, Alley 26 added a line of cocktail syrups and a variety of flavors. The new online store will offer the tonic syrup, strawberry syrup, raspberry syrup, and blood orange syrup to customers nationwide. The Kraft Cocktail Bar and Restaurant was one of five finalists in this year's Outstanding Bar Program category in the James Beard Foundation's annual awards. Allen 26 is the first North Carolina establishment nominated in this national category. Triangle Group goes coastal. A Triangle Real Estate Group is expanding to red-hot Brunswick County and looking to help out sea turtles as well. Century 21 Triangle Real Estate Group is opening an office on Oak Island. As part of the move, the group will donate $500 to the Caswell Beach Turtle Watch. This organization is simple and pure in all they do for all of us, says Stephen Votino, who founded the Triangle Group in 2013. Triangle Outdoor Dining snubbed. Apparently, the Triangle needs to up its game when it comes to outdoor dining. Open Table recently released its list of the 100 best outdoor dining places in the U.S. based on reader reviews. North Carolina had four on the list, including two in Greensboro. Getting the nod from Greensboro were Green Valley Grill and Print Works Bistro. Also making the list from North Carolina were the Sunset Terrace at the Omni Grove Park Inn in Asheville and the Oyster Rock Waterfront Seafood Restaurant in Calabash. Mega Spec facility breaks ground. The largest speculative industrial building in the history of the Raleigh-Durham MSA has broken ground, says Chris Norvell, a partner at Edgewater Ventures, which is developing the facility. The approximately 500,000-square-foot facility called Crosspoint Logistics Center is located at the intersection of I-95 and I-40 in Johnston County and has the capacity to expand up to 1.1 million square feet. The $40 million facility could bring hundreds of new jobs to the region and represents the industrial growth the Triangle is experiencing as more companies flock to the area. And finally, in a section called He Said It, a quote from Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, on the death, July 19, of former NC Department of Commerce Secretary John Scavarla. I'm sure I speak for the state's economic development community when I say that we mourn his passing and keep his family in our collective thoughts while still celebrating his many public service contributions to the state we all proudly serve. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, Hooking Confidence, How Justin Tu and Adrian Zhang Turned a $200 investment into a $5 million retail business by Woobling, spelled W-O-O-B-L-I-N-G. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. Justin Tu and Adrian Zhang are planning to celebrate the two-year anniversary of their Crafty Ed Tech business with a Shiba Inu Wooble, a tribute to their puppy who also turns two this month. But there's a lot more to the Wooble's story than designing and selling cute crochet critters. The recently married business partners have turned a minuscule $200 investment into a $5 million enterprise, and the momentum is scaling fast. The first year, we saw some traditional seasonality, busier at the holidays and slower in the summer. But this year, we're coming off the best back-to-back months we've ever had, in the middle of summer, Zhang says. Year one, revenues barely topped $1 million, but year two is closing at roughly $4 million. What they're selling is a DIY mentality that transcends hook and yarn, where woobling becomes the action verb for confidence. It's the principle of Fiero, achieving something you once thought was impossible, so you get this feeling of confidence and joy, Zhang says. Then you've got to tell the world. Sharing is a key component to why a couple hundred dollars has produced seven figures. The couple has leveraged social media to perfection, starting with an amateur video filmed in their parents' kitchen that remains one of their most effective ads. With numbers climbing daily, Woobles has more than 34,500 Instagram followers and nearly 14,000 Facebook followers. We're actually an education company. We focus on the learning process, and every kit pairs with an online step-by-step guide that teaches complete beginners how to crochet, Two says. Something magical happens when you learn something new. It's not about crochet, it's about confidence and proving to yourself that you can always learn something new. It's a message that has resonated time and again with consumers. 20% of sales are repeat customers, 90% of sales are direct-to-consumer via the website, and their presence is growing via Amazon sales as well as wholesale to retail chains, including Canadian superstore Loblaws and boutique stores and museum shops across the U.S. Similarly, businesses are jumping on the Woobles bandwagon. Google chose the company as the North Carolina business to highlight in its 2021 Economic Impact Report, which features one business from each state. We were excited to connect with Justine and Adrian and learn how they are pairing their kits with 120-plus tutorials on their YouTube channel, as well as using Google Ads and analytics to create campaigns that support sales and increase revenue growth, says Erica Swanson, head of community engagement for Grow with Google. Other businesses are using Woobles for team-building exercises. Wolfspeed is the first to have a Wooble custom design for its associates. Jonathan Kim, director of global trade compliance and policy at Wolfspeed, brought the idea to the company after watching his wife become engrossed with the amigurumi kits during the pandemic. I thought it would be fun to have a wolf design as part of our swag, he says. After discovering Woobles was a local AAPI-owned company, Kim, who is also chair of Wolfspeed's AAPI Employee Resource Group, ERG, incorporated the Wolf Wooble into a panel event in May, AAPI Heritage Month. Both Tu and Zhang are Asian Americans. Her family is ethnically Chinese, but from the Philippines, which she found confusing as a child, born and raised in New York. Zhang was born in China and moved to Oregon as an infant with his parents, who were first in their families to graduate college. The Woobles couple met as undergrads at Duke University, where she earned a bachelor's in electrical engineering with a double minor in visual arts and German, and he completed a double major in biomedical engineering and economics. After graduating, he worked on Wall Street, and she honed her skills in ed tech, leading UX, user experience, and working to understand how people learn. The whole reason I got into design is that I like to make things that solve problems, that have a use, that are helping people. Making a business, especially this kind of business, is the epitome of creating because everything about it did not exist until we did this, she says. That love for problem solving is at the heart of the couple's entrepreneurial synergy, and their engineering backgrounds prepared them to quickly identify problems and effectively develop solutions. In the beginning, she noticed customers were frustrated trying to learn. They'd get the crochet hook snagged and think they were doing something wrong. It wasn't the student, it was the yarn, which was traditionally woven in strands that was easily separated and frayed around the hook. Well, the best thing to do in design is to make it impossible to get to a failure state. So the way for us to make it impossible was to make it impossible for the yarn to fray, she says. Their solution was to make their own yarn for beginner kits. Our easy-peasy yarn is like a shoelace or a drawstring. It's just one continuous strand that can split, Zhang says, adding the yarn is currently made in China. We're very reliant on one manufacturer in China, and what we'd like to do is partner with a company in North Carolina to make the yarn, but we found out that the machinery used is very different than traditional machinery. If we can find a partner, maybe we can buy the machinery. It's been an interesting journey from when they started initially using off-the-shelf supplies bought at local craft stores and assembling each kit by hand in a time-intensive process that took at least 20 minutes a kit. In the early months, they spent weekends working in the basements of their parents' homes, typically assembling 1,000 kits a weekend. Our parents are very proud that they no longer have to be doing that with us, Zhang quips. We have a team now working in our warehouse in Apex and every day shipping a few hundred packages. Two, who created all of the initial designs, now has freelance designers working with her to develop and test new patterns, and she has a crochet book coming out in October. Zhang says the biggest challenge is meeting demand. The past couple of months, our demand has doubled each month, and it takes 2 months to get product from China, so the challenge is keeping everything in stock. We're in early conversations with two potential candidates to bring manufacturing back to where our business is based. Another challenge is warehouse space. The company has a 2,000-square-foot warehouse in Apex but needs 6,000 to 8,000 square feet. While they've found larger spaces, that mid-size footprint hasn't been found. Looking ahead, the most requests are for licensed characters, Disney, Pokemon, or Harry Potter, Woobles, ideas to dream toward. For now, that means we want to become the one-stop shop for all things crochet, Tu says. Fundamentally, it's an ed tech business that seamlessly blends the online experience with the physical kit, and opportunities to branch into other industries are alluring. We're building it in such a way that it can be scalable, so if we do want to get into cooking or sports or musical instruments, we have the right foundation to be able to do that, Zhang says. And we also have one news item in the 52 Shades of Success section. Mental health report reveals challenges. In recognition of Minority Mental Health Month, NAMI Wake is focusing on raising awareness around communities of Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and it references a recent report titled Beyond the Numbers from the national nonprofit Mental Health America. The report provides a brief overview of the challenges, statistics, and unique nuances surrounding mental health among BIPOC communities, Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Among the notable takeaways, individuals with multiracial heritage are one of the fastest growing demographics in the U.S. Multiracial encompasses a wide variety of identities, experiences, and perspectives. Of those living with mental health conditions, 25% identify as multiracial. There are 3.7 million individuals who identify solely as American Indian, Alaskan Native, plus an additional 5.9 million who identify as American Indian, Alaskan Native, and another race. The report estimates that 18.7% of this group have experienced a mental health condition within the past year. Of the 22.9 million U.S. individuals with Asian American Pacific Islands heritage, an estimated 2.9 million live with mental health conditions. The Black community numbers more than 45 million, with at least 3.1 million identifying as Black plus another race. More than 7 million people who identify as Black, African American, are living with mental health conditions. Within the U.S. Latinx Hispanic community of more than 61 million individuals, nearly 10 million are living with mental health conditions. The Latinx Hispanic community includes Latinx individuals who are not Hispanic, as well as Hispanic individuals who are not Latinx, and heritages from more than 20 countries are represented. And now we turn to the On Banking Tech page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Bankruptcies may rise soon. Attorneys say federal dollars staved off local bankruptcies. Weighed down by debt and supply chain disruptions, Revlon Incorporated, a major employer in Oxford, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization last month in New York. But Revlon wasn't alone, as Bloomberg reports that at 13 filings, June was the busiest month for large corporate bankruptcies in over a year. But statistics show that uptick is not trickling down to the Triangle, where bankruptcy numbers are falling. Attorneys who spoke with Triangle Business Journal credited government stimulus initiatives such as the Paycheck Protection Program with delaying a bankruptcy wave. "We've all been waiting for it," says Jason Hendren, a partner at Hendren and Malone in Raleigh. "I just think stimulus and money printing kept it away." He says his office is seeing an uptick in Chapter 11 consultations now that stimulus money is running out. "Obviously, with the increase in inflation and the rise of interest rates, we're expecting Chapter 11s to pick up, and we are starting to see the phone calls come in that support that," Hendren says. UNC professor follows Blue Origin spaceflight with trip to deepest spot on Earth. Just 3 months after his spaceflight, a UNC Chapel Hill entrepreneurship professor has journeyed somewhere even more exclusive, the deepest known point of seabed on Earth. Jim Kitchen, who in March journeyed 65 miles above the planet on a Blue Origin flight, recently returned from a dive to an area called Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific. He says his adventures are about his students as he returns to the classroom in 30 days armed with new life lessons. "It's to be able to teach my students to pursue their dreams and push boundaries and live fun and adventurous lives. Just continue to push. That's what drives me," Kitchen says. He says his journey to the bottom of the ocean, Challenger Deep is more than 6.5 miles below sea level, was comparable to going to space. "There's no sunlight, there's no oxygen," Kitchen says. "It's really cold down there, but there's this crushing pressure. It's really not hospitable to most life." The bacteria mats he saw at the bottom were not photosynthetic. Instead, they are chemosynthetic, using the materials in the water and in the rocks to sustain life. And that's where the space comparisons get really interesting. "If there's life out there, it's most likely that this is the type of life that would exist," he says. 1,000 job projects fill North Carolina's pipeline. Talk of an economic slowdown isn't hitting North Carolina hard yet. CEO Christopher Chung says the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina's pipeline sits at 236 projects as of July and up to tens of thousands of potential new jobs. This reflects the ongoing trend of mega projects, Chung says, pointing to individual projects that represent 1,000 or more new jobs. Executive Director Michael Haley says Wake County Economic Development is working on 37 active projects, including several large projects. Chris Johnson, Director of Johnston County Economic Development, says his team has responded to more than 40 requests over the last 3 or 4 months. We haven't seen a drop in activity, he says. And now we have a tweet of the week. This is from at Tim Sweeney, Epic. If you're in your early 20s or approaching it and you're feeling you missed out and that the field is full of established titans you can't possibly compete with, keep going. Your time will come. If not in the current wave of tech, then the next one. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from new Red Hat CEO Matt Hicks saying the firm is still totally committed to Raleigh, though he's based in Boston. I don't foresee that changing with me. And finally, a big number, 15,800. That's the record number of jobs as of July 12 that North Carolina has in incentivized wins for the year, meaning nearly $5.6 billion in investment. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page written by Evan Hoopfer. Greenville Airport eager to take off. Pitt Greenville Airport now has only 2 flights to Charlotte. Economic development officials in Greenville are trying to attract more commercial air service to Pitt Greenville Airport. Currently, only American Airlines offers service at the airport through its twice daily flights to Charlotte, says Tom Kilikowski, interim president and CEO of the Greenville Eastern North Carolina Alliance. He recently attended the 2022 Jumpstart Air Service Development Conference in Reno, Nevada, to meet with airlines about adding more service at Pitt Greenville Airport. The airport, which has 2 gates, is looking to increase connectivity for both leisure and business travelers. Kulikowski says the goal is to attract an ultra-low-cost carrier, or ULCC as they're known in the industry, to start service between Greenville and a vacation destination such as Orlando, Florida. Spirit Airlines and Allegiant Air are examples of ULCCs. Kulikowski says the demand is there given the fact that thousands of Pitt County residents fly out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport every month to Orlando. For a potential business travel route, he says the target market is Washington, D.C. He says one useful bargaining chip the airport has is a $750,000 incentive available for a carrier that would bring a D.C. route to Greenville. As far as existing service, Kulikowski says American is going to grow the existing service to Charlotte from the present 50-seat jet to a 66-seat jet in September. That represents an over 30% increase in available seats per day on the route. The statistics bear out that the people in eastern North Carolina come to Greenville to get educated for their health care and to recreate, he says. A lot of people would be coming here to Pitt County if they can get quality air service from the airport here. Beverage firm buys land in industrial park. Beverage distributor Aberdeen Coca-Cola Bottling Company purchased 54.4 acres in Moore County for $715,000, according to a deed filed July 1. The tract of land sits along Carolina Road near where it intersects NC Highway 211 and within Iron Horse Industrial Park. It's unclear exactly what Aberdeen Coca-Cola has in store for the land. At this time, we have not finalized our plans for the land we acquired, Vice President Mark Moon says. We're excited about the future and the opportunities this acquisition offers. Aberdeen Coca-Cola was founded in 1913 by G.C. Seymour and today serves all of Hope County along with parts of Moore, Richmond, and Montgomery counties. Iron Horse Industrial Park encompasses 128 acres in southern Moore County near its border with Hope County. Home builder now targets Nash County. Ashton Woods, based in the Atlanta suburb of Alpharetta, Georgia, has a sizable presence in the Triangle, but it is building a new community in Nash County for the first time. This is an opportunity for us to expand our geological footprint, our geographical footprint for the AW brand, says Rob Tesser, Vice President of Land Acquisitions for Ashton Woods Raleigh Division. The community called Middleton Farms will have about 120 single-family homes. The land sits along West Finch Avenue in the town of Middlesex. The company will target something in the $400,000 for a price point within the community, Tesser says. And in a section called She Said It, we have a quote from Oxford Mayor Jackie Sergeant after the city approved over 800 new homes in one recent city council meeting. People wanted development in Oxford. People are getting development in Oxford. And finally, a big number, $21 million. The amount Dallas-based Brazos Residential spent on the Bradford Park apartment complex in Greenville this month. The company is snapping up apartment complexes in outlying areas of the Triangle as Raleigh and Durham rents soar. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page written by Laura Brumette. Wake Forest Brewery looking to expand. Norse Brewing will try its Scandinavian theme in Zebulon. Norse Brewing Company carved a niche in Wake Forest Market with its Nordic-themed decor and craft beer offerings when it opened in December 2019 at 203 North Brook Street. From the beginning, owner Chris Jorgensen had a vision of the brand expanding to several locations. Now, Jorgensen and his team have purchased a building in downtown Zebulon to create the brand's first longhouse. Located at 120 North Arundel Avenue, the 1920s-era building will soon become Norse Brewing Company Longhouse. The two-story building was purchased by Jorgensen's Hidden Jewel Ventures entity at the end of May for just under $300,000. The space totals around 2,600 square feet. Jorgensen is working with local construction company Bobbitt to do a total upfitting of the old building and estimates the entire project will cost $1.8 million. The new concept will carry the brewery's Nordic theme and serve its craft brews and food items. Jorgensen recently hired Kyle Fletcher to serve as culinary director for the company. Fletcher has since elevated Norse Brewing's menu to include traditional Danish items made with his signature flair. The longhouse, expected to have around 20 workers, will have a kitchen on site but will receive deliveries from the kitchen in Wake Forest for most food items. In essence, it's a ghost kitchen for the longhouses. We could set the menu to whatever we want because it's all done in one place, Jorgensen says. We could do the same for other breweries. We prep everything here. They pick it up. When more longhouse locations are established, the same model will continue. Jorgensen is also considered offering the same service to other breweries that don't want to invest in hundreds of thousands of dollars into having their own kitchens. Jorgensen, who has a day job in pharmaceuticals, is also planning an expansion at the Wake Forest location. Expanding the kitchen there would increase its production capacity and therefore its value, he says. He's also looking to add a traditional beer garden outside, as well as more tank capacity in the building. Jorgensen is already planning for the next longhouse location, though he hasn't zeroed in on a specific site yet. Luxury student apartments to replace hotel near NC State. The DoubleTree by Hilton, known as the Brownstone Hotel, will soon be torn down and replaced with luxury student apartments at a well-known location near NC State University in Raleigh. Located at 1707 Hillsborough Street, the hotel was acquired by student housing developer Core Spaces for $42 million. The 190-room hotel built in 1966 will be demolished. A new building will rise in its place, likely under the company's flagship brand Hub on campus. The size of the new development has not yet been determined, says Joe Gatto, managing director of acquisitions for Core Spaces. Hub on Campus is our premier brand that we reserve only for the best products and the best locations and the best universities, he says. This is our highest-end product. The acquisition is the second in North Carolina for Core Spaces. The company paid $131 million last summer for the Stanhope student apartments in Raleigh. Triad's Village Tavern coming to North Hills. The Village Tavern, an upscale casual eatery based in Winston-Salem, is coming to North Hills. The Raleigh location is part of the Main District Revitalization Project that is under construction at the former J.C. Penney site. I've known John Kane for many, many years, and I've had my eye on North Hills, says Scott Richardson, founder of Village Tavern. I did look at a lot of other areas, but I just kept coming back. The new location will span 7,500 square feet indoors with a 2,500 square foot patio. And in a section called He Said It, a quote from Logan Martin of Skyline Strategies on recent efforts to put an end to several of North Carolina's obscure drinking laws. A law requiring patrons to buy a membership to enter bars was recently repealed. Next on the agenda, legalizing happy hours. It's time for a lot of these things to be updated. And finally, a big number, $42 million. That was the price tag on a Cary shopping center in a recent transaction between seller, Northwood Raven, and buyer, National Real Estate Management Corporation. The center, Brantford Shops, is home to the Triangle's first Publix store. And now we turn to the On Business page, written by Elizabeth Egan. Reborn Clothing finds new partner. Wind screens from construction sites will become tote bags. A new partnership between a Greensboro developer and a Raleigh-based clothing company may be giving fresh meaning to the phrase, everything old is new again. Samet Corporation and Reborn Clothing Company are working together to reduce textile waste by turning windscreens from job sites into tote bags. Windscreens are the material wrapped around fences at construction sites for security and branding. Tiffany King, Samet's sustainability director, says windscreens typically get thrown away after construction projects are complete, adding plenty of waste to landfills. She says Samet had already been strategizing about ways to reduce their overall footprint when the idea for the project came about. We produce a lot of waste, lots of dumpsters with materials, King says. We try to divert as much of that as possible through recycling efforts and finding these different partnerships like this as they come up to find ways to get the material reused, repurposed, whatever we can do, get it to other folks that could use it rather than just ending up in landfills. Emily Neville started Reborn Clothing in 2017 as a 19-year-old sophomore at NC State University. Her business began as a way for individuals to transform their old clothes into updated products such as tote bags, pillows, and laptop sleeves. Reborn has since branched out to working with universities and corporations on upcycling, downcycling, and corporate gifting solutions. King says Samet's Director of Corporate Social Responsibility, Elena Ewan, had already been connected with Neville, and the team at Samet was impressed with her work. Ewan says she started at Samet around a year ago. She went to a project site for the first time, and she saw miles of windscreen being thrown into dumpsters. She thought that there had to be a better use for the material and sent samples to Neville, who came up with the idea of using the textile waste to make tote bags, which are then given to employees and clients as tokens of appreciation. It's a way for us to show client and employee appreciation with something that's personal, Ewan says. Daughters of ESPN anchor pay it forward. The daughters of Stuart Scott, the famed ESPN sportscaster and UNC Chapel Hill graduate, have turned their late father's love of ice cream into a campaign to raise money for cancer research. In 2015, when Scott died of cancer, his daughters, Taylor and Sydney Scott, decided to get their father's favorite treat on his birthday, July 19. They posted a picture of their scoops on social media with the hashtag scoops for Stu, with ESPN colleagues and friends joining in. Each year since, both daughters have continued to post pictures for the campaign with the goal of raising money and awareness for the Stuart Scott Memorial Cancer Research Fund at the V Foundation for Cancer Research, based in Cary. Its grants, totaling $15 million to date, are directed toward research focused on racial disparities in cancer outcomes and general cancer research led by scientists from underrepresented groups. Cary Center adds a popular breakfast spot. A mixed-use development in Cary is adding to its food and retail lineup. The Arboretum at Weston is gaining a popular breakfast chain as well as a new Mexican eatery from the owners of a popular restaurant in Sanford. First Watch and La Victoria Cochina Mexicana, as well as Lucy Lou Children's Boutique, have committed to space, according to CBRE Raleigh, which handled lease negotiations for the property manager. Opening dates have not been announced. La Victoria Cochina Mexicana is a new concept owned by the Fonda Lupita Group, which is behind the Fonda Lupita restaurant in Sanford. And in the section called He Said It, we have a quote from James Avery, CEO of Durham-based ad tech firm Kevel, on the acquisition of Velocity, a Portuguese audience segment and remarketing program. We continue to build out our product functionality to enable our customers to build ad platforms, and this was kind of the missing piece of the equation. And finally, a big number, 21.5%. That's the amount the average rent in Raleigh-Durham increased from Q2 2021 to Q2 2022, one of the highest rates of increase in the nation, above larger cities such as Austin, Texas, 21.3%, and Phoenix, 20.9%, according to RealPage Market Analytics. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. We start with a column written by David Heinen, who is the Vice President for Public Policy and Advocacy for the NC Center for Nonprofits. The headline, Medicaid Expansion Would Strengthen Triangle's Nonprofits. Because of the confluence of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, the nonprofit workforce shortage, and inflation, North Carolina nonprofits are currently experiencing several major operational challenges, including, one, increased need. More than half of North Carolina nonprofits experienced an increase in demand for their services during the COVID-19 pandemic, and that need continues to grow as more people turn to nonprofits for help as their budgets have become tighter with the recent inflationary cost of living increases. Two, lost volunteers. Many nonprofits rely heavily on volunteers to deliver their programs and services. Unfortunately, North Carolina nonprofits lost about 40% of their volunteers in 2020, and the majority of these volunteers have not returned. Many nonprofits have had to hire or attempt to hire additional paid staff to fill positions that are typically covered by volunteers. Three, shortage in paid workers. On top of the decline in volunteerism, the nonprofit sector is now facing a severe workforce shortage. In a recent national survey, more than three-fourths of nonprofits reported having at least 10% of their staff positions vacant. One major policy solution that would help with all three of these issues is Medicaid expansion. By expanding Medicaid coverage to adults with incomes up to 133% of the federal poverty level, the North Carolina General Assembly could support the work of charitable nonprofits in three ways. One, complementing the work of many nonprofits that provide services to North Carolinians who don't currently have adequate health coverage. Two, providing health coverage for some employees of nonprofits that don't offer group health plans and whose salaries leave them in the health care coverage gap. And three, providing payment for some types of Medicaid-eligible services that nonprofits currently provide to clients for free. With ever-rising health care costs, Triangle residents in the health coverage gap, i.e., those who would qualify for Medicaid under expansion but can't otherwise afford basic health coverage, are turning more and more to nonprofits to meet many of their basic needs, such as food, housing, and child care. Perhaps more importantly, Medicaid expansion would create healthier communities. Nonprofits are at the core problem solvers, and many of the problems that nonprofits solve are exacerbated when the people they serve don't have access to health care. The center has heard from almost every type of nonprofit, including food banks, crisis assistance centers, affordable housing providers, community health centers, domestic violence agencies, and consumer credit counseling services, that their overflowing caseloads would be significantly reduced if the people they served received the preventative health care that they needed. More than one-third of organizations that participated in the center's 2020 survey of salaries and benefits in the state's nonprofit sector reported that they aren't able to offer health benefits for their employees. Because most respondents to this survey are well-resourced organizations, it is likely that an even greater portion of the overall nonprofit sector, particularly smaller nonprofits and those that pay relatively low wages, aren't able to offer health benefits to their workers. For nonprofits with workers in the health coverage gap and for organizations that can't fill jobs because they can't afford to provide health benefits, Medicaid expansion would be a tremendous job recruitment tool. Nonprofits report that one of the biggest reasons they have trouble filling staff positions is that they offer insufficient benefits. For many low-resource nonprofits that can't offer high salaries or competitive benefits, Medicaid expansion would provide quality health coverage that might make meaningful jobs a more sustainable option for potential workers. Further, there is a strong correlation between volunteerism and physical well-being and mental health. Consequently, it is quite likely that Medicaid expansion would significantly increase the pool of potential volunteers for nonprofits, helping fill some of the gaps in volunteerism that have persisted for the past 2.5 years. Many nonprofits provide health and behavioral health services that are covered by Medicaid. Because nonprofits operate for the public benefit rather than to make a profit, many organizations provide these services to people regardless of their ability to pay. For nonprofits such as behavioral health providers, health centers, hospitals, and free clinics, Medicaid expansion would be a significant new source of revenue to help pay at least a portion of the cost of providing these services. And in the nonprofit briefs, wounded veteran gets home in Durham. A U.S. Army veteran and his family got the keys to a new home in Durham thanks to Drees Homes and the Operation Coming Home nonprofit. Retired Staff Sergeant Michael Kaser received the keys June 9 as they parachuted in. Kaser was severely injured when he deployed in 2008 and has competed in Paralympic events since 2011. Green Hawk Development provided the home site in the Bright Leaf at the park community. Military children get chance for free camp. Two camps in North Carolina in the towns of Columbia and Ellerbe will benefit from a gift of $60,000 by Bob Evans Farms to help the families of veterans and military personnel. The money helps send a child to camp for a week and extends a Bob Evans Farms program called Our Farm Salutes. The new dollars will look to help 100 kids get a free week at camp. WGU NC Anniversary Scholarships. To commemorate the five-year anniversary of its launch, WGU North Carolina, an affiliate of national online nonprofit Western Governors University, announced the launch of WGU NC 5th Anniversary Scholarships. Five winners will receive up to $10,000 in tuition credit, the largest amount ever for an in-state scholarship from WGU North Carolina. The scholarships will be awarded based on applicants' academic records, readiness for online study, and demonstrated financial need, as well as other considerations. Recipients will receive four credit installments of $2,500 per six-month term, dispersed over their first four terms. Durham effort to help newborns become independent. Durham-based Family Connects International launched an independent nonprofit July 19. The program looks to connect nurses with newborns and their families in their homes to provide care in the earliest days postpartum. Sharika Hill, who has served on the Duke University faculty as a clinical epidemiologist, is the executive director. Family Connects looks at evidence-based solutions to help infants get off to the best start possible and looks to connect new parents to the community resources they need to best provide for their child. And finally, Duncan franchisee gives to Special Olympics. Duncan franchisee George Ross made a $30,208 donation to the Special Olympics of North Carolina as part of the celebration of the opening of the new Duncan store at 920 High House Road in Cary. The store opening was June 22 and included athletes and representatives from Special Olympics of North Carolina. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, will North Carolina's $1.2 billion penny stock bet pay off? On July 12, the Vietnamese conglomerate Vingroup announced its subsidiary, VinFast, wants to raise $4 billion to build its electric vehicle plant in Chatham County. The corporation has commissioned Citigroup and Credit Suisse to help raise $2 billion each, either through debt or equity financing, so we can get the North Carolina plant going, hiring thousands of workers and selling the EVs in the U.S. Just a day earlier, North Carolina lawmakers finalized the state budget that showed the state's taxpayers will dole out as much as $1.2 billion in various incentives, including Job Development Investment Grant of $316 million over 32 years, state appropriation of $450 million for site preparations, road improvements, and additional water and sewer infrastructure, community college training worth $38 million, Golden Leaf Foundation grant of $50 million, and $400 million in incentives from Chatham County. This all sounds exciting, but exactly how much do we know about this company? VinFast is Vietnam's largest listed company with a market value of $11.4 billion, with businesses in retail, real estate, and resorts. Since VinFast's parent is a public company that trades in the Ho Chi Minh Stock Exchange in Vietnam, the financials are out there, and it reveals a company that is searching for answers. While the financials are in Vietnamese dong currency, converting the numbers into U.S. dollars provides an interesting snapshot. For example, Vingroup is a penny stock trading below $3 a share. The company expects $6 billion in sales this year and an after-tax profit of about $260 million. These are big, ambitious numbers, especially looking at the firm's last quarter financials that show revenue of $800 million, a drop of 22% year over year, and a pre-tax profit drop of 31%. Vingroup's stock price has dropped more than 30% in the past 7 months. And the company planned a big U.S. IPO this year, but senior officials are now saying the IPO could be delayed because of market conditions. That begs the question if the company will have to leverage itself even more to meet its financial obligations. Already in May, Vingroup officials said the company was issuing 84 million shares at $4.81 a share, adding $403 million to its coffers, but that also diluted the shares. Of course, we all want VinFast to succeed. After all, the company has promised some 7,500 new jobs and expects to see about 600,000 EVs in the U.S. market by 2026. But think for a moment. If this were a U.S. company, say from San Francisco, would North Carolina approve billion-dollar-plus incentives with these financials? I would bet no. Unless, of course, our lawmakers are more interested in touting big economic development achievements through press releases for election reasons. Having Credit Suisse and Citigroup on board to help raise the money is a huge step in getting the EV plant in Chatham County ready, but the funding needs to happen. Otherwise, there will be no plant in the near future. Based on the financial strength and the recent murmurs about Vingroup's operational strategy, it is clear this deal is a huge gamble for North Carolina. It is true that if VinFast is unable to create the new jobs, there will be no JDIG grant available, therefore reducing the potential taxpayer exposure, and the state appropriations of $450 million for infrastructure improvement along the Triangle Innovation Point, or TIP, site will only make the site more valuable for other companies scouting for land for big manufacturing projects. The next big event for the state's largest economic development win is now in the hands of Citigroup and Credit Suisse. And now we have a general news story in the Triangle Business Journal. 20-story tower shows nearly 400 residential units. This is written by Cliff Barnes. After receiving approval from the city of Raleigh to rezone its downtown property, the owner of 1.43 acres off South Wilmington Street has submitted plans for a 20-story mixed-use building. Titled Real Estate Partners of New York City, the same group planning to redevelop the Hillsborough Street property that holds the Round Holiday Inn, is the owner of the property at 521 and 529 South Wilmington Street. Located behind Lincoln Theater, the Wilmington Street mixed-use project calls for two adjoining buildings and a parking deck. Site plan submitted to the city shows there will be 387 residential units in the tower. Title informed Triangle Business Journal of its intentions for the property last November, saying that downtown Raleigh is one of the most dynamic urban centers in the southeast. Ayal Enoch, principal with Title Real Estate Partners, indicated that the walkable nature of the site makes it well suited for a residential project. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.